December 13th, 2012. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago, where it's a relatively sunny day. Kind of cold, but sunny. Thanks for joining me today on RBN for people who can handle the truth. RBN's website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit spingola.com. During the program, email your questions or comments to spingola1 at yahoo.com. My regular email is deanna at spingola.com, and I invite your comments. However, I do not access that email during the program. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by going to spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Christine Hayek, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. She is the president and founder of Gentle Giants Draft Horse Rescue. That website is Gentle Giants Draft Horse Rescue, all one word, .org. Welcome to the program, Christine.
Thank you, Deanna. Thank you very much.
I received, if a person donates to any animal organization, then they receive requests from other organizations that deal with horses or deal with animals. And a couple of weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, I got a letter from you and read through it and was, well, very shocked at what the letter said. And I thought, I just need to contact her. This needs to be made known. And you talk in your letter about horse slaughter returns to United States as President signs bill. And so I would first like to have you talk about this and then talk about your organization. And for people who go to the website gentlegiantsdrafthorserescue.com, they can see, view a short 4-minute video. But anyway, talk to us about this bill and what it entails.
Sure. Well, it seems like there is a little bit of confusion about what happened on November, it was November 18th of last year. There was a USDA spending bill, and this was basically a bill that would outline how the USDA was allowed to allocate and use tax dollars for its funding. And back in 2007, a very tiny, just 7-word piece of a sentence was added in the section that talked about what tax dollars could be used to allow USDA meat inspectors to inspect. And it had said that tax dollars could be used to pay these inspectors, but then they added a semicolon, and it said, except for the carcasses of equines. And this was the little piece that back in 2007 had basically stopped horse slaughter in the United States. There was never a law, and there was never a ban, but if the USDA meat inspectors cannot inspect an equine carcass for export, and because Americans do not eat horse meat, there would be no reason to slaughter a horse here. So at that point in time, horses that had been slaughtered in the United States now were exported to both Canada or Mexico. And that had actually already been happening at that time. Horses were still exported to Canada and Mexico back then. But now it kind of moved it there permanently. On November 18th of 2011, that little half of a sentence was removed. So now it is legal for horse slaughter to return.
Okay. Christine, we are going to a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Christine Hayek. Am I pronouncing your last name properly? Christine?
It's Hayek.
Oh,
It's fine. Everybody does it.
Hey, Jack. Okay. Alrighty. I will make a little note to myself. Okay. Please continue with this narrative about the things that we don't know that are going on with our government, and there certainly are a lot of things that are going on.
Well, there has been a very common misconception that there was at some point a ban or a law that outlawed horse slaughter in the United States, and actually there really wasn't. It was just this little loophole that had made it not profitable. Since that time in 2007, our U.S. horses have been being exported to Canada and Mexico. That is still commonly happening. However, every year the numbers are going down just slightly. European demand for American horse meat has been decreasing, basically because Europeans have been led to believe that these horses were raised to be meat animals, just as we would raise cattle or pig or chickens. And many were not aware that these horses are actually, these horses are domestic pets. These are horses that people, you know, performed with. They raced. They showed. They were brood mares. They were pleasure-owned horses. These were lesson ponies. And that presents quite a few different problems. Number one, it's emotionally and ethically a problem for many people because they feel it's wrong to consume an animal that's been raised and since birth has been trained to develop a companionable relationship with human beings and then to later eat that animal. And the second more pragmatic problem with that is all of these horses have been given drugs their whole entire lives that are not approved for human consumption. And in fact, many of them are specifically banned from human consumption. So this in and of itself creates quite a problem when it comes to consuming horses who, you know, are privately owned horses that have not been raised for meat.
Oh, my. Well, I can certainly relate to that. When my children were small, we purchased a lamb, and we thought, oh, we'll just, raise it and slaughter it. And, oh, my goodness, the kids brought it in the house, and he was just so darling. We couldn't slaughter this poor little creature. I just couldn't do it. Couldn't imagine doing that.
I can't either.
And I've had horses, and we had a couple of ponies, Welsh ponies. And I just love animals, all kinds of animals. And I just can't imagine, I wouldn't kill anything, actually, personally.
Well, you know, I think one of the most common misconceptions people have when I talk about horse slaughter and how passionately I feel against horse slaughter, I just want to throw it out there. I'm not a vegetarian. I'm not necessarily against the concept of someone eating an animal. I am against the concept of commercial farming and how many of our animals are raised and treated. I think it's quite inhumane.
Oh, absolutely. But
I think we get into a different level of cruelty. There's many levels of it, but when we have an animal that from the moment of its birth typically is imprinted by a human, and horses are very slowly trained to overcome their natural instinct of looking at a human as a predator, because to them we are, everything from our physical appearance to the way that we move and the way we interact is as a predator, and we very slowly condition them to stop seeing us as such and to start looking at us as not only a companion but also a leader. And to have an animal that we've trained their whole life to work for us, to participate with us in sport and recreation, even to earn us money, and then to reward them for their service with this horrible, horrible end is simply inconscionable, whether you agree with eating animals or not. To me, it just seems like such an incredibly immoral idea. And to watch videos of horses being slaughtered, it's very common that even, the moment that they're about to receive the captive bolt and they've watched many horses in front of them, dying, and they've heard their screams and they've seen them drop and they smell the blood, and they'll still reach their faces forward looking to that human for comfort.
Yes, of course, and they have feelings. I don't really believe that animals should be put in cages at zoos. I don't believe that animals should be part of circuses because I recognize that they are mistreated. I am just very, very fond of all animals. I'm okay with snakes even because they are creatures, and I believe that humans have a stewardship to protect and care for the animals, not torture them, not slaughter them in such a terrible, terrible manner. And I have watched parts of films at where they slaughter cows, and I can only watch just a few moments, and then I can't take that anymore. And you have a picture on one of the pages on the back page of the first page that I had to cover it with my hand so that I could read around it because I have a very, very tender heart. I really do.
And well, it certainly sounds like you do.
And I believe that people, well, at least I have found that I can communicate with animals in a way that we understand each other without saying anything. And I have three cats, and, well, all three of them favor me. I'm always the favorite person in any home that I've ever lived in, you know, with my parents or in any other home. I'm always the favorite person because the animals sense that I am their friend. And so this really caught my attention. I just and when you explained how they slaughter them, and horses are special. Horses are very special. Like I mentioned, we had two Welsh ponies, and I trained them. They were wild, actually wild. We bought them as wild horses. They were on an island in the middle of the Salt Lake. I was living in Idaho at the time. It was probably, you know, we thought, oh, we're in Idaho. The kids should each have a pony. And it seemed like a really good idea, but I had no idea how to train a wild animal, a wild pony. But I did it because it was just persistence and showing them that I cared about them. And it worked out great. They were just, you could just do anything with these animals, touch them anywhere. Just they learned to trust human beings, and it worked out great.
Yeah, it does. Well, you know, horses are incredibly perceptive, you know, animals. You know, anyone who's spent much time around horses, I don't think would argue that they have incredibly distinct personalities, very defined preferences. We've had hundreds and hundreds of horses come through the rescue. I've yet to meet two who are even remotely similar. You know, they're all as different as human beings are.
Indeed. Now, how many horses have you placed?
We have placed over 300 horses in homes. And that's only counting back to 2005, because that was the time that I incorporated Gentle Giants into a nonprofit. Prior to that, I had been rescuing draft horses just a couple at a time here and there, keeping them for a few months, getting them healthy, and then finding them a home, taking whatever money I had gotten from, you know, selling the horse to a good home and making them sign a contract that if they couldn't keep the horse, they would let me know. And then going and taking those funds and rescuing others. When it kind of got to a point where I had five or six rescue horses at any given time was the point that I decided this is the time that I need to go ahead and make this, you know, a formal nonprofit organization. And it's grown from that tiny hobby to now being a farm that can house up to 75 horses. We currently have 61 in residence. We've placed hundreds in homes, and they span 109 acres.
Oh, my.
Who knew?
Right. And you just recently moved to this area, correct?
Well, we've always been in the same town, but we recently, in March, were able, after about 5 years of saving, to be able to purchase a farm that now exists in the rescue's name. So it has its own place to be, and we're no longer at the mercy of, being a renter or a tenant and having lease negotiations every year. We were really kind of getting into a situation where the idea of housing 60 horses and knowing that your housing could be dependent on another person's decision-making was pretty terrifying. And we were very, very lucky to find, a property that the rescue could own.
This is wonderful. And obviously you have the support of your family.
Yes, absolutely. My poor husband, he doesn't even like horses.
Oh, really?
Not like I do. I mean, he likes horses. He thinks they're fine animals, but he's certainly not passionate about them. They are not his passion, but he's a wonderful man, very indulgent with my hobby.
And it's somewhat more than a hobby. I mean, this is, as you say, it's a passion.
Yes, it is.
All righty, we are going to a quick break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Christine Hajak. She is the president and founder of Gentle Giants Draft Horse Rescue. The website is gentlegiantsdrafthorserescue.org. Please go there. Make a donation, sponsor a horse, get involved. This is a really good, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing you're doing, Christine. Just amazing that we have people like yourself that are willing to step in and give your life basically to help others, to help animals who have no other source of help. Certainly not the federal government.
No, certainly not. In fact, we were just having a little chat in the online chat room about the Mustangs, and that could probably be a whole other segment in and of itself.
Oh, yes, and somebody said the Bureau of Land Management is so corrupt, as are other government agencies, and their rounding up of Mustangs is just terrible. I mean, it's just awful. I always say, well, the animals were here first, and we need to learn to cohabit. We need to. I mean, I have skunks in my neighborhood, and I would never think of herding. Well, I actually had a skunk when I was a child as a pet, I just love all kinds of animals, and we need to learn to coexist.
Yeah, we certainly do. The nightmare that's going on with our wild horses, and these horses are the property of the American people, and they're living on our national land. It's really terrible what's happening. The Bureau of Land Management is a very, very corrupt organization, and a lot of the information that's put out is incredibly false and misleading. What's terrifying to me is there's so much evidence of what's going on with our Mustangs and how grossly the BLM is being managed, and it just seems like no one will do anything about it. And I don't understand, because it seems to me that it's become even a pretty national exposure. It seems pretty common that people know what's going on. There are fewer Mustangs on our national lands than there ever been historically in the world before. There's no evidence that the horses are needing removal because of starvation or overbreeding. Basically, the Bureau of Land Management wants to rent those national lands to farmers to graze their cattle. And they're renting these lands to these commercial farmers for far less than what the average, going rate would be if you compare the BLM lands, our federal lands, to what privately owned land is renting to a commercial farmer for. But of course they do this because it's big industry, and they're paying all the lobbyists, and they're making, humongous donations to politicians to support their causes. As you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. There's even photographic evidence of them moving cattle in on the same day that they've rounded up Mustangs to move out. And this is all at a cost of billions of dollars to the U.S. taxpayers. They have something insane like 30,000 Mustangs being held in captivity, that we're paying billions of dollars in tax dollars to feed these horses every year so that they can live in tiny cages like zoo animals. And there's no need There's no reason they can't be out on the range, other than corrupt government and money.
Yeah, it's all about money.
Yeah.
All about money. Amazing. And the idea, too, of going back to what you said earlier, of eating an animal that has been raised to trust human beings is just so egregious. And I know that in other countries they do eat animals that we would never dream of eating. Mike emailed me and he said, talked about China and their love of cats, eating cats, and it just grosses me out to even think about that. Or a dog, or any small animal, domesticated animal. And yet, you indicate in your letter that that after these horses are slaughtered, their meat is served in restaurant tables in Europe and Japan. Some of it is sliced very thin and often eaten raw.
Yes, yes. Oftentimes, horse meat is eaten raw.
Oh goodness!
You know, certainly in many European cultures, it's very commonly consumed. In Belgium, France, Italy, Japan, different countries have different preferences. Japan's very fond of draft horses and foals. You know, France tends to prefer just kind of middle-aged horses. You know, each different country kind of has their preferences. In Italy, horse meat wasn't all that commonly consumed until they had a huge outbreak of, I guess it was the hoof rot, the hoof and mouth disease. And that basically destroyed their cattle business for a time period. And at that point, the horse meat kind of stepped in as the, there was a big spike in consumption of U.S. horses and demand. One of the most rampant pieces of misinformation that I hear about horse slaughter is that we have to have horse slaughter in order to control the unwanted horse population. And there's so much evidence that states that that is not true. If you look statistically at how many horses have been slaughtered every single year, we know that we've been in a recession for several years, and all of our horses are becoming more and more affordable. Horses are very inexpensive, if not even free right now. However, right. The rate of horses being slaughtered every year is declining. So this is not going to solve this problem. They're completely not related.
All righty, we're going to a quick break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Christine Hayjack, the president and founder of Gentle Giants Draft Horse Rescue. The website is gentlegiantsdrafthorserescue.org. And so horses can now be taken, at least what, nearly 100,000 American horses are trucked to Canada and Mexico for slaughter each year. This is basically 2,000 horses per week and nearly 300 a day. And many of those are draft horses. Could you tell us what a draft horse is?
Well, draft horses are the large working breeds. So, you know, think obviously the most famous would be the Budweiser Clydesdales. That's certainly not the most common breed. There are several different breed of working horses. Most of the horses that we are rescuing, and it can be, you know, we have Clydesdales, Belgians, Percherons, Shires, Brabants, Suffolk Punches. There's many different breeds, and also those breeds can be kind of mixed together. Most of them are actually coming from the Amish community. And, you know, the Amish community is very large in Pennsylvania and Ohio and some of southern New York, and they still are using these horses to actively work their farms. And unfortunately, once these horses become unserviceable, and it might just be a very minor injury. You know, when you have a horse that's pulling a 4,000-pound plow, it doesn't take much of an injury to make that horse come up with a limp or not be able to work a full day. And those animals are simply disposed of, and as quickly and efficiently as possible. And often that's through sale to slaughter. And therein, to me, lies the problem with horse slaughter. And that is that horse slaughter creates a venue for human beings to be financially rewarded for poor behavior.
Oh, indeed.
You know, there, I hear lots of reasons. Oh, horse slaughter needs to exist because of there's an overpopulation of horses. Well, that's a human-created problem. You know, horse slaughter needs to exist because people can't afford their horses. That is also a human-created problem. You know, horse slaughter needs to exist because people don't want to be responsible owners. Well, to me, that's, you know, that's not a fair way to make a horse pay for a human's mistake. But by having horse slaughter, basically, we're encouraging and financially rewarding people for being irresponsible human beings and for not being good stewards of their animal. People have a choice to make when they have a horse that they don't want for any reason. You know, they can choose to rehome the horse if the horse isn't a viable horse to rehome. Say it's injured, it's sick, it doesn't perform well, then they could have the horse humanely euthanized, and that would be a pain-free, fear-free death. But most people would prefer to take the horse to a slaughter auction and be rewarded with $400 or $500 for getting rid of that horse. So it does give a very quick, silent, and tidy way for people to get rid of their unwanted horses very quickly, very anonymously, and to be rewarded for doing so.
So there is a big difference between slaughtering and humanely putting a horse down. But I think that horses who are no longer can no longer work, I think that they should have a pasture and eat grass for the rest of their life. I you know, if an animal has worked hard all of its life to help the human, they deserve a nice retirement in a nice green pasture somewhere.
I agree as well, specifically when that horse is injured or can no longer work because of what the human has done to it. Say, for example, you're a competitive show jumper, and this is what you do as your sport and your hobby, and your horse performs well for you, but after 10 years of show jumping, which is not a normal behavior for a horse, they begin to develop arthritis in their hocks. You know, just as someone who, you know, would, a human who competed in an extreme sport would probably develop arthritis in their knees. You know, that horse has earned a retirement. On the other hand, however, I do understand that not all people are financially capable of providing that. To me personally, I won't take on another personal horse that I am, as an individual, responsible for unless I know that I can keep that horse for the rest of its life. I understand that not everyone's going to take that stance. So I also do think that it is acceptable that if you have a horse and through your use of that horse, you injure that horse and you, to the point that it can't perform for somebody else, then I also think it is reasonable to look at basically providing humane euthanasia and giving that horse a painless and fear-free death. It's certainly kinder than the alternative. It might not be the ideal, but I do believe it's a humane alternative. So I don't want anyone to think that Gentle Giants is against horses being, you know, humanely put to sleep. We certainly are not. If someone has a horse that they can no longer care for or keep, that is always a kind alternative. Sending a horse to slaughter should not be an option.
Right. Now, slaughter why don't you tell us how these horses are slaughtered?
There's a couple different methods that are used. The method that used to be used in the United States is currently used in Canada, and that is a method called the captive bolt. And this was designed to be humane for cattle. What happens is the animals are lined up in basically a press pen. They slowly get pushed forward one at a time until they go into what they call the kill box. And the kill box tightens on both sides to kind of squish the animal in place. Its head protrudes through a window. Now, with a cow, that works pretty effectively because they have very, very short necks and they don't have a large range of motion. And at that point, a person reaches forward with a captive bolt, which shoots a 4-inch bolt into their forehead, The idea being is this method is used to knock an animal unconscious. It actually does not kill the animal. It's only to stun them. At that point, the kill box opens, they string the animal up by a back leg, and they slit its throat. So what happens with horses is horses have a neck that's several feet long. They have a humongous range of motion with their neck, and they are very, very fast. They also are flight animals, so it's their nature to avoid being struck in the forehead by this bolt. So oftentimes horses are hit multiple times in the face and neck. It's very common that the horse is not dropped on a single strike. And because a horse has a brain that's approximately the size of a walnut and it's located so deep within the skull structure, most of these horses are not actually rendered unconscious. They might be stunned, they might be shocked, they might drop to the ground because of excruciating pain, but they're not actually unconscious. And many horses are slaughtered fully aware of the fact that they're being eviscerated while alive. So that's the method that was used in the United States and is used in Canada. Believe it or not, that's kinder than what happens in Mexico. In Mexico, there's very little regulation of how horses are slaughtered, and there's not nearly as much technology. Horses are commonly killed with what's called a puntilla knife, which is a sharp knife that basically they enter a kill box, and the butcher will lean over and they get stabbed repeatedly in the spine, kind of where their neck connects to their wither. The idea being, this is only to basically incapacitate the horse. They're still able to feel. They just can't kick or move as effectively. And so they also are slaughtered fully conscious. So this is why, you know, right now we have wonderful legislation that's sitting in our Senate and our Congress, and it's all tied up in committee, and no one will bring it to the floor and vote on it, and that's absolutely terrible. But this is the American Horse Slaughter Prevention Act of 2012, and if we can get this legislation passed, what that would mean is that our U.S. horses could not be slaughtered here, nor could they be exported for the purpose of slaughter. It even goes so far as to say that you can't transport a horse with the intentions of selling it to a second party who will then take it to slaughter. Certainly not foolproof. Nothing is when you get to humans, because humans are sneaky. But it would create quite a difficulty. It would basically end this mass killing of our U.S. horses. It's wonderful legislation.
So what do we do to let our so-called representatives know? What do we do?
The most important thing, and Gentle Giants has been doing a big push, and we've gotten over a million signatures, to Congress to let them know that the American public does not want this. Independent polls have shown that almost 80% of Americans do not want our horses slaughtered, whether they're going to be eaten here or abroad. They're very opposed to the idea. But the most important thing is every individual needs to contact their congressperson and their senators and let them know that it's important to them that they co-sponsor these bills and that they bring them to the floor for voting. We can collect as many signatures as we want, but a congressman from Colorado is not going to care that an organization in Maryland is, opposed to horse slaughter and really wants their support.
Okay.
So we need the public, and we need the public to be aware and to know of what's going on. And we need to make our representatives know that this is a make-or-break issue. And if they don't support it, that we're not going to support them.
Right. Of course, they often do exactly what they want to anyway, despite what the citizens want. But I really think that the way that a person treats an animal says something about their character. And, I'm frankly surprised that the Amish would be so heartless as to take their animals to slaughter. I find that very, troubling. I've worked with some Amish when I was a fabric rep. I had customers that owned quilt shops, and in Illinois, in central Illinois, in Arthur, and they seem very compassionate, very considerate people. I just can't believe that they would do this, knowingly do this to their animals.
Unfortunately, it is quite common. I've actually, and of course, there's variations to all ends of the spectrum. I've talked directly to some Amish about it, and some have actually said outright that they think that, you know, I'm being overly emotional and very sentimental about all of this, and it's just the practical way of life. And, you know, when you're done with the horse, you send it to slaughter, and you get some money, and you use that to buy another one that's better.
Yikes.
Yeah. We actually see a lot of neglect also coming out of the Amish community. They certainly do not provide veterinary care or farrier care to the standard of the normal horse-owning public.
Oh, my. Well, that is troubling also. Although I'm against all allopathic medicine because I think that the vaccines are very dangerous, and I mean, shooting live viruses into an infant certainly isn't my idea of a good thing to do. And there's certainly a lot of proof, that medical proof that indicates that it is very dangerous. So I never had my animals. I didn't have the vet come out. I had the vet come out just to check their general health, but they didn't receive any pharmaceutical drugs or anything like that. I grew organic produce and whatnot, and they got the best food that I could, you know, that was available. Amazing. Animals are just part of our family, always have been.
Well, I mean, I think I'm a little bit, when it comes to medical care, I come from a much more moderate standpoint. My education and work is being a paramedic, so of course that's based in Western medicine. I see both sides. And here at the rescue, we use a lot of conventional medicine, and we also use a little bit of Eastern medicine as well. We're very big proponents of chiropractics and massage and acupuncture for our horses. As part of their rehabilitation process. But, you know, when you have an eyeball poked out, sometimes you need antibiotics and surgery. So,
of course.
You know, and these basic things really do seem to be neglected within that community because they're expensive. You know, that level of care is expensive. And at that point, I guess that, you know, they determine that it's not worth the cost. We have one Belgian here who was Amish who just sustained a laceration to her eye, and it wasn't treated, so she suffered a really nasty infection, and she kept the eye but eventually went blind in it, and we purchased her at auction for $25. The slaughter buyer was not going to touch her because you can't slaughter a horse that has an open infection. But, I mean, to me that would be like they just threw out a perfectly good tractor because they didn't want to take care of the headlight.
Right.
She cost us less than $80, you know, to have a vet come look at her and heal her eye. But she wasn't even worth, you know, that investment to them.
Wow. Well, of course, I think, you know, if I have a broken leg, I'm going to go and have it set. And of course, I mean, I just, one of my cats had a kidney stone and she had surgery. It was, I don't know, $1,700 and it was not, you know, that's the way that you take care of your animals in the best way that you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. And the other thing that I read in the paper frequently, and it makes me just so furious, is that these people who have horses that do not feed them, and we see pictures of their rib cage showing, and I just want to go and just, you know, strangle the owner that would be so cruel as to let their animals starve.
Well, you know, and I hear a lot of people who like to connect horse slaughter and starvation, abuse, and neglect, and they really are not connected at all. Number one, I mean, people who say, oh, we need to have horse slaughter because otherwise there's going to be starving horses everywhere. Well, we do have horse slaughter right now. You can take your horse to any local auction, and there's probably a kill buyer who's going to be there. You would not believe the tiny little places they go, buy up horses. And a lot of the people don't necessarily know that they're there. They look like you or me, but probably wearing a little bit more flannel.
All righty, we are going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. All righty, welcome back. Our guest today is Christine Hajak. She is the president and founder of Gentle Giants Draft Horse Rescue. That website is gentlegiantsdrafthorserescue.org. And we were talking about people who for some reason just fail to provide their horses or other pets with sufficient food. And I know that you really can't compare that to rescuing an animal and that it has no connection to slaughtering animals, but just the treatment of animals in general is just terrible. Just terrible in this country, and I think it's commentary on how people think. I think that we have a less respect for life than we used to, and I think it's tied to some of the other practices that the government has initiated, has done. I mean, if you're going to kill babies and say it's okay, it's free choice, and I suppose you're just likely to kill anything that you happen to want to kill just to get rid of it because it's convenient or it's profitable or you just have want to get to $500 or whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know, on the topic of starvation, I mean, we commonly, you know, hear people make this analogy, this comparison, and I mean, Gentle Giants is very active with animal control facilities in our state and surrounding states, and we will always work with animal control whenever they have cases of starving horses that involve draft horses. It's very hard for them to find placement for those horses because most people just don't have everything from the facility to house them to the trucks and the trailers large enough to move them. And so, of course, we have all that specialized equipment. But when it comes to starvation of animals, that is really a place where mental illness comes into play. I really do not think that any human being who is not profoundly mentally ill could stand to look out their back door and see an animal starving to death, because there are so many options. That owner could have chosen to sell their horse. They could have chosen to give it away before it got that bad. They could choose to call their local animal control or animal shelter and surrender the horse. They can even choose to haul it off to auction and sell it. So there's always choices that can be made. And, you know, we've been involved in probably 10 or 15 pretty horrific cases involving starvation and extreme neglect. And in every single one of those, there was not a financial factor. Those people were capable of caring for their animals. They simply chose not to because of their mental illness. So I really do feel that the two are not associated. I get furious and very excited and rambunctious when people say, if we don't have horse slaughter, there's going to be horses wandering the street and horses are going to starve to death. And it's infuriating because it's simply not true.
Absolutely.
There's no evidence that backs this idea up. There's 9.2 million horses in the United States. That's a lot of horses. And if only 100,000 are going to slaughter each year, we're talking about 1%. Okay. This is not an unsolvable problem. 1% is not unabsorbable.
Okay. We are going to our 60-second top of the hour break. We will be right back, and we'll take some phone calls at 800-313-9443. Welcome back. This is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. This is Deanna Spingola. Our guest today is Christine Hajak. She is the president and founder of Gentle Giants Draft Horse Rescue. Her website is gentlegiantsdrafthorserescue.org. She incorporated that in 2005 and have found at least 300 homes for horses. And you were saying that 100% of, or 1% of the horses, 100,000 horses a year, are going to slaughter, and in my opinion, that's 100,000 horses too many. Mike emailed me, and he said, he asked this question. He said, would this kill box work for politicians?
It probably would be perfectly humane for politicians.
Indeed.
I would approve it.
I was laughing and just yes, leave it to Mike to come up with a really good idea. Oh goodness. Now, if people want to help, you have several things on the back of your letter. You can sign a petition that will alert the president that you oppose horse slaughter in the U.S. and shipment of American horses to other nations for slaughter. Now, is there a petition online that people can sign?
There are several independent ones, but none that are an official. And really, the most effective way for people to make a difference is to send a personal email or a personal letter to their representative, because those are really the things that get noticed. And, you know, we try our best. We've gotten over a million, petitions in, but it really is that personal factor. I mean, people who really want to make a difference, you can actually ask your representative for a face-to-face meeting. I've done this several times down in D.C., and I've asked some of these congressmen who do not support this act point blank, why? Because there really is no realistic reason why having horse slaughter benefits the U.S. public. The corporations that are consuming these meats are foreign-owned entities. It's been proven that typically how they operate is they will use kind of shadow companies. So they will process the horse meat and then sell it to themselves at a loss under a different company name, so that they can avoid paying taxes. The slaughterhouse that had been in Kaufman, Texas, had been absolutely genius with this. Dallas Crown it sounds very American. It's actually a Belgian-owned corporation. It functioned as Dallas Crown here, and then was Chivitico there, sells itself the horse meat at a great loss, and ended up paying $5 in federal taxes when they made like $4 billion. It's absolutely absurd. They've shown that slaughterhouses and areas are a humongous ecological drain. They drop property taxes. EPA violations are just out the wazoo. Nobody wants to live next to this. Nobody wants this in their neighborhood, because employees of slaughterhouses tend to be immigrant workers, and they tend to be very uneducated. This is not going to bring U.S. jobs. You know, this is not going to solve employment problems. And the average slaughterhouse only employs 42 people. So we're not talking about an industry that's going to solve any of the United States' woes here. It doesn't benefit us. It benefits Indeed. The consumers, and our horses pay.
Indeed. All righty, we are going to a three-minute break. We will be right back, and please feel free to call in at 800-313-9443. And I'm also interested in some of the other corporations that are involved in this. Be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Christine Hajak, the president and founder of Gentle Giants Draft Horse Rescue. The website is gentlegiantsdrafthorserescue.org. are some of the corporations that are involved in this kind of the behavior, slaughter, ones that we would recognize?
Well, most likely not. Pretty much the major players are Dallas Crown, Beltex, and Cavell. And all of these corporations are actually Belgian-owned enterprises.
That's amazing. Now, do they, and of course it's for profit, do they eat horses in Belgium?
Yes, they do. Belgium's one of the major consumers of horse meat. And actually, Anheuser-Busch is now owned by a Belgian corporation, and as soon as that takeover happened, they cut the Clydesdale program in half and ended their grant program to support horse rescues.
Oh, that says a lot about that company, then.
We get asked all the time, well, why don't you get Budweiser to sponsor you? And I'm like, you have any idea that they're owned by the largest consumer of horse meat?
Oh, my.
Yeah.
All right, we do have some callers lining up.
Wonderful.
Take a call. Let's take John in Washington. John, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. Deanna, it's nice to speak with you. And Christine, I've been, our family owns horses, and I've been really interested in your discussion today.
Well, thank you, John.
I just have a few questions. Would you support a nationwide program like we do with cats and dogs for spaying and neutering horses?
Well, neutering definitely. And I know that on the state level, many different organizations have tried to make inexpensive gelding services of intact male horses more affordable. It already is pretty affordable, though. I think, I mean, we're here in central Maryland. We're very close to Washington and to Baltimore, so we're in a pretty affluent area. And even here, having a horse castrated is only about $200 to $250. And to me, that just is not a serious amount when you're considering, you know, an ultimate luxury item like a horse. I mean, you know, this is a
true
major investment.
Well, I'm a little bit blown away because, you know, we live in a world where there's a lot of bad things happening. And so for me, I have a hard time trying to balance where my energies are best spent. And there's the abortion issue. You know, there are these ongoing wars where not just horses but humans are being slaughtered. And it's probably more than 300 a day, you know. And so it's hard for me to – I mean, how do you balance that?
Well, I balance that by the fact that I tend to like horses a lot more than most people. And I do agree. Everyone has to choose basically their fight. And for me, this is my fight, which isn't to say that I don't care about the others. It's just this is the one place that I've found that I, as a human being, can make a difference. So this is where I'm going to direct my energy.
How do you feel about if the horses were slaughtered humanely? I mean, because you're talking about horse euthanasia. Would you support using that meat if the horse was euthanized?
Well, you can't. Because humane euthanasia typically involves an overdose of barbiturates. And at that point, the horse meat would be poisoned. It would actually be deadly to anyone who consumed it, which is why, you know, after euthanasia, the horse's body needs to either be properly buried or it has to be cremated or it could be composted or rendered. But you can't euthanize a horse and just leave its carcass there to rot because any wildlife that came that ate off of it would most likely die because of the high concentrations of the barbiturates. So,
boy, there's got to be a better way. I mean, if there was found a way that we could, maybe we would have to haul the horse to Canada, but if they could be killed humanely, would you be in favor of their meat being used for, you know, just so it doesn't go to waste?
I think my reason why I would not is because I think that that would only encourage doing this for profit. Right now in England, say for example, you could have a horse that you wanted to have slaughtered for your family to have the meat, and you would take it to the local abattoir, and they would do a single kill. They would either come to your farm and shoot the horse in the head, which is a humanely accepted method of euthanasia, and they would process the horse, or you could take it to the slaughter facility and have it done there in a single kill room. However, that is never going to be a viable method of commercial processing of horses for consumption. It's very, very costly.
Talking about the cost of a bullet, basically. And, I mean, I don't mean to disagree with it, Christine. It just seems like if we really want to solve this issue, the solving it at the slaughterhouses is the easiest way to do it. Because
no, it's not the cost of the bullet. The bullet's almost, you know, free, basically. What it is to have it be humane, it needs to be a single kill room, which means one horse in the room at a time. And after that horse is killed, that whole room needs to be cleaned. And only after it's cleaned does the next horse come in. And that way they're not seeing other horses being killed. They're not smelling
to the other horses.
Yeah, they're not smelling the blood and the organs. They're not predicting what is going to happen to them. And the other expense is also having someone who is a trained expert in doing this. And oftentimes slaughterhouses hire minimum wage labor. These people are not trained. They are not experts. You know, they don't know how to properly operate this equipment. So, I mean, am I going to go to England and argue with an abattoir? No, I'm probably not, because that's probably not a horrific death for a horse to suffer. But when it comes to, and I'm specifically saying commercial processing of horses, there hasn't been a method found that can even remotely be called humane.
Thank you very much, Christine. My last question is, are there any other telltale signs of a kill buyer besides them wearing flannel?
Oh, I'm sorry. That was a joke. typically, if you attend a local auction and you pay attention to who's buying, or even just if you can't see who's buying, if you listen to what numbers are being called out, because often a bidder will have a number, if you notice that one person is consistently buying horses that are under $400 or $500, regardless of their appeal or whether or not they can ride or if they're sound or lame, that is most likely a kill buyer. They are actually contracted by the slaughter plant, and they'll give them an order to fill, and they'll tell them, I want 60 horses, and I would like this percentage to be young horses, and I would like this percentage to be draft horses. Most people also don't realize that the horses that are at risk for slaughter, these are not our old and our ill and our lame. In order to be slaughtered, a horse has to be weight-bearing on all four limbs. They want the horse to be of a good, healthy weight and musculature. These are not going to be old, starving horses. Obviously, the kill buyer is getting paid per pound of the horse when it arrives. They're not going to take a horse that's a rack of bones to slaughter. It simply will not be worth their time in the investment of fuel. So most horses that are slaughtered, about 93% of them are under 10 years old, and about 98% of them are healthy horses. So these are not necessarily our old and our sick. The argument, however, of using horse slaughter to dispose of our old and our sick, to me, is kind of extra offensive, because these horses have already worked their whole lives. They don't deserve to be rewarded that way. But most people aren't aware that what we're talking about is a relatively young, healthy population of horses.
All righty. Thanks, John, for calling in. Let's take Kim in North Carolina. Kim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Deanna, and hi, Christine. I love your website. I've been looking it over for quite a while now. It's terrific.
Oh, thank you, Kim. One of our volunteers does it. Isn't she wonderfully talented?
Yes, it's great. It's great. And I am familiar with all of this. It's terrible, because I have to say I am a proud vegetarian. I don't believe in any kind of slaughter. I think it's horrible. But I am also not a pacifist. I realize that people are the most evil creatures on earth. And if somebody comes in my house and somebody's leaving in a body bag, it's not going to be me. And I really have to concur with what you say about the Amish, because I grew up right near Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Oh, so you're very local.
I have a lot of hand experience with watching how the Amish treat their draft mules and their horses. And I've watched them just literally be run into the ground on a hot day. And it's terrible. And I have to say, you know, people tout the Amish as being some, you know, great group of people, but they're really some of the biggest sellouts. I mean, they were some of the people who, back in the 70s during the swine flu vaccine, they were the biggest contributors of eggs for the swine flu vaccine to Wyeth Laboratories in Westchester. So, you know, there's just a lot of things that people aren't aware of, and we really are lied to about everything in life. It's such a shame. And we have a lot of animal neglect here in the rural area of North Carolina. We have a association called Horse Helpers. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Not specifically that group, no, unfortunately.
Right. They're pretty good, but unfortunately the county we live in, they can't do anything if the horse is not in actual obvious pain and as long as it appears that they have food and water. We have a neighbor down
Kim,
the road.
Kim, could you hold on? We're just going to a break. We'll keep you over the break, and we'll continue this on the other side.
Thank you.
Be right back in 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Christine Hajak. She is the president and founder of Gentle Giants Draft Horse Rescue. The website is gentlegiantsdrafthorserescue.org. And we had Kim from North Carolina who called in. Kim, continue your question and comment.
Mentioning horse helpers, unfortunately, the area I live at, it's just terrible with animal rescue, and, you know, I am trying to do something about that. It's very difficult. We have a lot of rural people that raise animals, and some of them are very humane, although I've never really seen anything humane about any type of slaughter, even if it's on a small farm. I mean, tell me a nice way to slaughter meat. It's horrible. But our neighbor had let her horse's hooves go to such a point where one, you know, the front hoof, one of them was like 7 inches long and the other front hoof was 2 inches long. And he literally spent the last 5-6 years of his life crippled. And I wish you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, neglect is certainly a very hard topic because, unfortunately, in most states in the United States, animals are still seen as property. Which leaves kind of limitations on what abilities our humane, you know, agencies have to enforce laws. It's slowly getting better, and certainly funding seems to be a big problem. Maryland's a pretty aggressive state. We're very, very lucky here, but even so, what you said is very much correct. There's not a lot that can be done if food and water are on the premises and available to the animal, and there's not a lot that can be done if the animal is under the care of a veterinarian. So it does become very, very difficult. And a lot of people also don't realize that there's a lot of pressure on those humane organizations that when they impound and take horses or animals from a negligent owner, those bills have to get paid. And the rehabilitation of those animals is overwhelming. Last year we had 10 starving horses that were taken from an owner in Maryland who had 146 horses removed from her care, and it was such an overwhelming case that all of the rescue organizations in Maryland had to kind of group together to help with this effort. There wasn't one of us that was big enough to take on 146 horses. We ended up with 10 of those horses, and in less than a year, you know, our bills for the care of those horses ended up being over $38,000.
So were they able
to investment?
Could they save them all, or did they have to euthanize any?
Only 7 ended up being euthanized. All the other horses survived. Sadly, though, this person actually ended up receiving half of her horses back. She made a plea deal.
Oh.
And she was awarded 60 of the horses back, and the remaining horses were adopted out through the shelters who had helped care for them. it was a really distressing case, you know, for those of us who were involved in the care of the horses, because this was a really, really severe case.
Why did they give 60 of them back, and do they monitor them?
There's only monitoring for 1 year, and, you know, sadly enough, what it comes down to is money. The individual had basically threatened that they would appeal and appeal and appeal and appeal every single year, and that what that meant was these horses would remain tied up with the rescue organizations that were caring for them, that we would not be able to adopt them out. We would have to continue to care for them until this case finally came to resolution. And all of the organizations that were involved, you know, how long will they be able to financially sustain the burden of those animals? You know, after a while, it's going to become difficult to raise money for them. People will forget about the story. You can't adopt them out. And the county's not going to reimburse you for your expenses. So, sadly, and I don't really agree with their decision, but the, you know, Queen Anne's County, Maryland, decided to make a plea deal with this individual.
Interesting, but terrible. I hate to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one of my points is, isn't it ironic that right now, really, our corporate governments are sort of doing to us what we've been doing to animals for hundreds of years, so... kind of proves the theory, what goes around, you know, comes around.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do wish more people were vegetarians. I know people have a hard time with that, and you'll always hear, well, you have to eat meat to be healthy, but I'd rather err on the side of compassion, and maybe if I wasn't as healthy, I'd still be happier, because I just feel like you have more of a heart. And
mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen that documentary that was put out years ago, Earthlings?
Yes.
Yeah, I couldn't even watch but about 3 or 4 minutes of it. You know, I've tried to go through and watch parts, but it just covers everything from what they do in animal testing, circuses, fur, slaughterhouses, and, you know, if people would put a slaughterhouse in the middle of your town with glass walls, and you could look at that and eat a steak afterwards, well, I don't know. I don't think you could have much of a heart. Oh, but I thank you so much for what you're doing. And
well, thank you very much.
Glad we have people like you here on Earth. Sometimes it seems pretty dark.
Well,
thank you, Deanna.
Thank you, Kim. Appreciate your phone call. We are taking calls at 800-313-9443. We are going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Christine Hajak, the president and founder of Gentle Giants Draft Horse Rescue. Her website is gentlegiantsdrafthorserescue.org. And let's see, what else can we do here? We can contribute if we want to help sponsor some of the animals that you have. You also have people who donate time and spend working with the animals. Of course, you'd have to live there in the area. How many people do you have? How many volunteers do you have?
We have a total roster of approximately 200 volunteers, but I really have to call out a huge prop to our... We have a group of about 40 volunteers, and these volunteers are incredibly committed. And some of these volunteers can only give us a day a month, but they give us a full day. Others we see as often as 2 and 3 days a week. And, you know, they're really invested. They treat their volunteering here like a job. They'll even call out sick, you know, if they're not able to make it. And honestly, I don't think that we could do the work that we do without them. You know, they're kind of our workforce. And we are a volunteer-based group, so we couldn't get by without that help.
Right, and you mentioned in an email that you were out picking up horses the last couple of days. So you have equipment needs. You have to have a large truck, probably. You have to have a horse trailer. How do you fund all of this?
Well, all of it is donation driven. I mean, we are completely dependent on our donors for support. We do receive some grants from independent foundations, but we do not receive any government support, whether it be local government or federal government support. So we're, you know, we're very lucky. We've gotten here, you know, very long-term slow growth. It's taken a long time for us to get this big, but we do rely on our donors to keep doing the work that we do.
Right. And now your husband has a regular job?
Yes, he does. He's a firefighter.
Great. And this is your job. And and you are the one that actually goes out. Now, do you have any, you said most of all of your volunteers are volunteers. They don't get paid.
Mm-hmm.
So they go out.
Neither do I.
Bless your heart. This is a labor of love, right?
Yes, it is.
Oh, goodness. And you've always been a horse owner?
Yeah, most all of my life. I started asking for a horse when I was 4. My parents have no idea where this came from. It just kind of popped up out of the blue, and it only took me 2 years to get them to relent. So I got my first pony when I was 6 years old.
And were you living in a country environment?
No, we actually lived in a really suburban environment that was pretty developed, but there was a boarding facility down the street where I was able to keep my pony. And years later, I actually realized that where my poor pony lived in the beginning of her years with me was kind of a dump, but we didn't really know any better because we had never really, you know, learned or seen any better. And with time having horses, we became a little bit more educated, and eventually my family ended up buying a farm, and my mother got into horses. She still has horses as well.
That's amazing that you as a child could influence such decisions.
I am the youngest, so I was a little spoiled.
Okay. The truth is out. Ah. And so when did you start doing the draft horse rescue?
Well, oddly enough, I did not grow up around draft horses. I grew up around fancy schmancy warm bloods and dressage horses, kind of upper echelon of riding. And I actually rode a draft horse in a riding lesson when I got bumped from the horse I was normally assigned to. And I just had so much fun. It felt amazing to be up that high. It felt incredible to feel the ground shake as you cantered through the arena. And it was an instantaneous connection of, this is for me. Like, this is what I want. And several months later, I ended up going out and purchasing my first draft horse, which I bought from a show barn, and was greatly ripped off. And shortly after that, on impulse, I was attending an auction to buy barn supplies, and I decided to stay to watch the horses go through. And on impulse, I ended up buying a kind of ugly, surly-looking Belgian gelding who just was an absolute gem of a horse, you know, pretty is as pretty does kind of guy. And he ended up just being a superstar, the nicest horse I've ever owned. And when I went to gather him up, I found his owner crying in his stall, and I asked him, you know, what was wrong? I'm sorry you had to sell your horse. And he said, I don't care about selling the horse. I didn't want him to sell to the meat man. And I stood there in shock. What are you talking about? And he explained to me about meat buyers. And even though I had owned horses my whole life, and at that point I was in my early 20s, I had never heard of this, meat buyers and horse slaughter. And I was absolutely horrified. Even though I had had horses my whole life, this was the dark underbelly of the horse world. No one ever talked about it. They didn't tell you that's what happened to your horse when you took it to the auction. And I was mortified. And after meeting that first lovely horse, whose name was Elijah, I kind of built the rescue in his honor. He lived here until he was 28, and he was buried at the first Gentle Giants in the first location that we existed. And now it's kind of become my mission to go find all the Elijahs in the world, because these horses are perfectly usable. They're very much wanted. There's quite a demand for people to find a very calm, well-trained, pleasure-use horse that they can just get on and relax and have fun. And, you know, that's exactly what these, you know, older workhorses can do and do perfectly. They've mm-hmm. seen everything in their lives. They've worked the fields. They've driven carriages down the road. You know, they've pulled loads of food to market. They're pretty unflappable, and they do tend to have very calm demeanors. So they're a lovely choice for an older rider who maybe they rode in their youth or always, you know, fancied themselves to be a rider, but they might now be a little heavier and more breakable than they had been in their youth.
Right. Now, you said that the first time that you rode one of these large, large animals, that you just felt the earth moved almost. How much do they weigh?
On average, about 2,000 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah, their feet are about the size of a good dinner plate, and they can be pretty substantial. So 2,000 pounds is not an uncommon number for a well-fed draft horse.
Wow. Now, how much food do they eat a day?
Well, I guess it depends on what season we're in. They'll eat pasture and forage pretty much continually. That's kind of hard to quantify because you don't really see what's going in.
Sure.
So if we're talking in the winter, it's not uncommon for a draft horse to eat a 60 or 70 pound bale of hay daily, and they'd probably still be wanting a little more.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
So, well, when you weigh 2,000 pounds, I guess you eat that much.
Yes.
Very interesting. There's some other questions. What were they? Have you ever been injured by a horse? Have you ever been kicked? Has one ever accidentally stepped on your toe, your foot?
Well, constantly. Let's see. Yeah. You know, kicks happen. They're pretty uncommon because draft horses, you know, typically aren't very aggressive. Oftentimes more it's an issue of, the Amish don't train their horses to stand for a farrier in the conventional sense that most people use a blacksmith. They use a large piece of equipment called the shoeing stocks where the horse is restrained, and we do have a set of shoeing stocks, but they're rather dangerous for the horse, and they can be incredibly dangerous for people. So we always go through a retraining process, because when our horses get adopted, they need to learn how to stand for the farrier. And we tend to do that a little bit more effectively than other people because this is what we do. So I do get kicked doing that quite often. I got kicked really bad a couple years ago when I accidentally ended up between two horses that got into a fight when I was in the wrong spot, and, you know, kicks to both legs and broke a couple ribs. Few concussions and a broken left arm. But other than that, pretty good.
Okay. Well, given the number of years you've been around them.
Yeah.
So what would cause two horses to get into a fight?
This was actually an incident where we were getting ready to go riding, and the horses were tied up getting tacked. And as one horse was being cinched up, it just reached over and nipped at the horse that I was tacking. And the horse that I was tacking was rather offended that this horse that was socially beneath it thought that it had the right to bite it. And it wheeled to kick, and a kick fight ensued. And I had just happened to be grooming my horse's hip when this happened. So it was actually my horse, one of my personal horses, that kicked me. And as soon as she realized what she did, I could see on her face that, you know, really, she had no intention of kicking me. She was really meaning to kick the other horse. I just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Sure.
Accidents do happen. You know, I mean, we certainly here, we teach a lot of safety first and use common sense. And, you know, we try to keep our volunteers safe and our visitors safe. But, when you're working around 2,000 pound animals, sometimes an accident will happen. We've had people, you know, accidentally get a toe broken if it gets stepped on the wrong way. The horses are kind. If they realize it, they're going to move their foot as fast as they can. You know, but sometimes it's too late.
Sure. And you mentioned that there was some sort of a social status that horses, or you implied that there was a status.
Social structure and herd structure is like the most important thing in a horse's life. They it is very important to them to know, you know, what the hierarchy is within a group, and that group is ever changing, and that group also does include people. You know, as herd animals, horses are always looking for a leader. They actually feel most comfortable when they have a leader, and oftentimes they'll even look to humans to be their leader. And if the human won't be the leader, then the horse certainly will, because the group needs to have a leader. So, yes, it was very offensive to my horse when this horse that was much beneath her decided to reach over and bite her on the shoulder. That was not permitted, and so in their social structure, she needed to reprimand that.
That is amazing. Now, in what way would a human be a leader? How would that work?
Typically, it starts to happen in very, very subtle ways. You know, basically, you're being a leader by horses want to feel calm, they want to feel relaxed, and they want to feel safe. So if you're the kind of person that emits that energy to them, they're going to find you very enjoyable to be around because you're going to make them feel better. But if you can also show them through training and experience that you are not going to hurt them, that they can trust your decisions and that your decisions will keep them safe, then they will learn to trust your judgment and look at you, you know, as their leader.
Okay, and they do, we've all seen movies where a barn is burning and so somebody rushes in and they blindfold the horse in order to lead them out of the burning barn. Do they, and of course they understand when they are going towards a kill box what is going to happen to them. So they do express fear and they have the same kinds of emotions that humans have. And they also, we've often heard of the horse whisperer, or at least I have.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about this gentleman?
Well, there's several people that claim themselves to be horse whisperers. So I guess it depends on which specific person.
Okay. I guess I've just heard of one. But is that a possible scenario?
Well, typically when someone uses that term, what they're really talking about is natural horsemanship, and that can be kind of a broad spectrum of interacting and training a horse that uses a horse's naturally ingrained communication skills and their method of learning to work in a very cooperative way with them rather than an aggressive or fear-inducing way. And it basically uses all forms of natural horsemanship, use the idea of pressure and release to train a horse. Basically that you apply a form of pressure, not necessarily physically, but even just emotionally, and then when the horse performs the action that you wanted it to have, you release that pressure, and that rewards the horse, and that's when they realize how to make the pressure go away. So a very easy example is, if I want to teach a horse to turn left, when I pull on the left rein, I'll pick up the left rein and apply a little bit of pressure. And the horse is going to try to figure out how to make that stop. So they might put their head up, and they might put it down, and they might turn right. And the second that they start to turn left, I'm going to release the pressure and tell the horse it was a good boy.
Right.
And after a couple times of repeating this, the horse is going to know when she touches that left rein, the way I make that touch stop is I turn my head left.
Okay.
And then we've used a pain-free, anxiety and fear-free method using the way that a horse thinks to teach it what we want. Because really what they want is for us to leave them alone.
Really?
So horses will learn very quickly how to answer our questions in the most effective way possible so that they can get back to eating. Because that's really what they want to do.
Right. Because usually when you see horses in a pasture, they're always eating.
Yes. They're very good at that.
But I think that's a normal behavior. I mean, that is, they're grazing. That's what grazers do. They eat all day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they have to. They have to have, their digestive systems are meant to have food continually moving through them.
Uh-huh. And they are designed to eat what kind of food? What would you not give a horse?
Well, they're designed to eat, a vegetarian diet, and it's primarily going to be mostly forage and roughage. It's going to be pastures, little bit of legumes, so mostly grasses, hays. It's slightly unnatural for horses to eat concentrated feeds in the way they do today with commercially produced grains. We certainly use them because, you know, they're no longer wild animals. They can't, you know, range over thousands and thousands of acres, so it's hard for humans to give them a nutritionally balanced diet without some supplementation. But obviously, you know, too much of the candies and the sugars and the breads and things like that are bad. I am a big fan of carrots and apples as treats.
All righty. We're going to a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today has been Christine Hajak. She is the president and founder of Gentle Giants Draft Horse Rescue. The website is gentlegiantsdrafthorserescue.org. And we were talking about the food that horses eat. And I believe you were mentioning apples and carrots or something when we had to go to break.
And of, making friends through food. A lot of the horses that we receive that come into the rescue here have had very, very difficult lives, and many of them actually don't know what these treats and snacks are. So it actually takes us a little bit of time to introduce them to receiving apples and carrots as treats. And sometimes visitors to the farm are a little disheartened when they try to offer a new arrival an apple and they won't take it, but the horse simply doesn't know what it is. And it's typically through them finally observing other horses eating them from us, and soon they'll get brave enough and they'll try it themselves. And once they take that first taste, it's all done.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was just kind of a normal thing to give to a horse. But the ones that you rescue, well, that's what you're saying. You're rescuing horses, and obviously rescue means that these horses have been deprived in some way. Amazing. Well, I am certainly very glad that there are people like you. I certainly agree with Kim, the caller from North Carolina, that we need people who do focus on one particular thing, and that is how things do get done. If we have 20 or 25 different issues that we're thinking about, sometimes we get stuck and we don't know what to do and just feel like we can't do anything. Where you have just focused on this, you've given it your all, you've given it your time, your effort, your talents, and you're making a difference. And I think that's a fabulous thing for you to be doing. And I applaud your husband for his support in your doing that. Now, do you have children that also participate with you?
We do. We have volunteers over 12 years old just because we found that, you know, our horses are incredibly large, so it's very difficult to have very small children around them. And also because we don't have a staff that can really be directing and supervising children one-on-one, we really have to limit it kind of to older children.
Okay, but I meant your family. Do you have family that...
I have three stepchildren. Sadly, none are particularly involved with the horses. They all really, really wish Mom and Dad had chosen to live in the city. You always want what you don't have.
Isn't that true? Or the grass is always greener on the other side.
Yes, yes it is. They all are very artistic and musically talented and not very inspired to go pick up a bunch of horse poop every night.
Yes, and that takes a lot of effort and certainly needs to be done. You're right, because there are things that need to be done that aren't necessarily pleasant. Do you also do organic gardening that you could use the things that you have to collect?
Huge garden here that the volunteers help work. We do all the garden work from horses. And we grow a ton of food here. In fact, about half of my family's food is provided by the garden, which, of course, is manure fertilized.
How wonderful. Well, thank you so very much for being on the program today.
Thank you very, very much for having me, Deanna.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you tomorrow.